Recording?
Yeah, recording.
Recording.
This is Mom's Basement Podcast episode 27.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. I am William, sometimes Hank.
I'm Rudy.
And I am Mike.
Mm-hmm. So the whole Mom's Basement crew is here. We just finished playtesting Noam Chomsky, Noam Rosen games. Demulet.
Yes, Demulet.
And we're going to be talking about that in the second half an hour.
Yep.
First, though, we want to discuss a topic that's come up a few times this week in play and in discussion. And that's, what makes a role-playing game a role-playing game? I mean, at what point does something cease to be a role-playing game? Excuse me. And to use Ron Edwards' metaphor, become playing poker with funny hats on, doing voices.
Yes.
Oh, and that's my dog, Obi, who's making a guest appearance. Yeah. Yes, today, we're not in Rudy's basement.
Nope.
We're not in Rudy's parents' house. We're in my parents' house.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're not in my parents' basement because it's a contemporary 80s style home on a slab that doesn't have a basement.
Oh, right.
So today we're in Mom's
kitchen.
Breakfast nook.
Yeah, breakfast nook.
But I am still eating because someone has to hold up our standard of professionalism.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Most of the rest of us have already completed that. So, anyway.
So, where does this begin? Where does an RPG really begin? And where does it end?
You want to take it first, well, Rudy?
Well, I just wanted to mention sort of a case study here.
Go for it.
This came up in one case in a discussion over Steve Mather's other game. We played his one of his games, In Gennaro, a couple weeks ago. And he has another game, which was a Ronnie entry, Uncle Louie, which was a strategy card game about intrigue in the court of King Louis XIV. And the question was, is it an RPG or isn't it an RPG? Ron Edwards said, funny hats playing poker, not a RPG. So that was what got the discussion started. And it also has application to the game that we played.
Yes.
And that we're going to be talking about later, Demulet, because that got the same kind of response. It's another Ronnie's Award entry, and it got the same kind of, well, this isn't really a role-playing game. This is a strategy game where you could talk in funny voices if you wanted to.
Right.
So, Rudy, RPG, where does it begin? Is there a line after which something ceases to be an RPG?
And I think as long as you can shoehorn role-playing in some way, it's an RPG.
So could Risk be an RPG if I talked in a Ukrainian accent?
Yeah.
See, that's something I don't quite follow. I think it should be role-playing first. But it is a little looser than that necessarily. I mean, it doesn't need to have, like, massive amounts of role-playing inside it.
Right.
My thing is, if you can role-play about an equal amount equal to the strategic play time, you're good to go. You can't just shoehorn it in, however, in my opinion. Right. It kind of has to feel like it belongs there. You know what I mean? Like it's natural to the game.
Right.
Like,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Agree with Mike 100% on this one. I think there has to be a natural, intuitive connection between the role-playing and the mechanics.
Yeah.
They have to complement each other. They can't be two isolated, discrete, distinct things. If you could take role-playing out of the game entirely and still be able to play the game 100%, then I think you're really into maybe not a role-playing game territory. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean that you've designed a bad game by any stretch of the imagination, just that you haven't really designed a role-playing game. And I think the mechanics that do exist have to foster in-character action, have to foster narrative, have to foster interaction.
Yeah.
And that there should be a way for the narrative elements or the story elements to feed back into the mechanics. It's one thing to have mechanics that create the story elements, but the story elements should also, be able to dictate the mechanics. Which is something that games like Uncle Louie and Demi Lich maybe don't have, because in those cases, generally the feedback loop only works one way, which is you can set a scenario in narrative terms, but the way you set the scenario doesn't fundamentally alter the type of resources you have, the type of moves you can make.
Although it sort of did in Demi Lich.
That's
the way you set the scenario did sort of.
Somewhat, but it doesn't really change your plans in the end. It just changes how you're going to shape what you're going to do. Because so much of it is, as we'll get to later, is argument-based.
That's
true.
distracted slightly.
See, I think almost anything can be turned into a role-playing game. The question is whether it's designed as a role-playing game or not.
Okay.
That's a fair assessment.
You want to expand on that point?
Like Demi Lich is obviously, and Uncle Louie were obviously designed as role playing games. I guess. I mean.
Well, now, when you say designed, you mean that they were called role playing games?
I mean,
it goes beyond simply titling it.
It means you make conscious design choices that include role-playing, maybe. Because he did have the section in the manual that's like, well, he did have role-playing in mind in a lot of cases. Because there is a section in the manual that's like, well, how do you role-play a Demi Lich?
But that feels almost like an afterthought.
Yeah, it's kind of detached from the rest.
I mean, both of the games in question, Uncle Louie and Demi Lich, have a section that comes at the end of the, near the end of the manual. That says, oh, how do you roleplay this? And it's almost like they designed their game and then they sat back and said, wait, how do you roleplay this? And then added it on as an afterthought.
I mean, there was intent to make a roleplaying game because the intent of each of these games was for contest for roleplaying games. However, they didn't realize until after they finished it that it wasn't necessarily a roleplaying game, in my opinion. They did the creative process. It might have worked out slightly different. But for whatever reason, they had to include that little addendum at the back.
And, I mean, let me just say that both of these games are awesome games. Demi Lich was a ton of fun to play. And Uncle Louie seems very fun from a design point. We haven't played it yet. But maybe not are very fun RPGs. I think one thing is, if you start to feel a tension developing, like, or like, oh, it's role-playing time. And I don't really want it to be role-playing time. I want to move the game forward. Then I think that's a sign that the mechanics are starting to eclipse the role-playing element of the game. And when you have a game that is almost like a kind of perpetual motion machine, meaning it generates its own energy, the mechanics generate all their own energy and are self-reliant. Then you get the sense that role-playing is almost peripheral. And it almost seems like, oh, time to stop playing the mechanic, time to stop playing the game and have this role-playing moment. And sometimes that almost seems like a char. It seems like an afterthought.
And I'll say this much about Demi Lich, though, in this case. It has about as much role-playing as D&D, because...
I was about to ask that. Let me ask you this. D&D role-playing game
is
no.
Yes, that's a fair question.
That is a fair question. And, you know, it's been niggling at the back of my mind as we've been talking through. I guess that's the inevitable question, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it tries to have this focus on role-playing, but I'm not quite sure if it really is. It's definitely a fantasy game of some sort. But besides that, I don't know. I had about as much role-playing as this did, and I wouldn't call Demi Lich a role-playing game. Because you could go through... You could go through a whole D&D campaign just describing what you're doing instead of actually role-playing out the character.
And a lot of groups do.
Yeah.
In fact, the role-playing elements really had to... I mean, what we consider role-playing had to be patched on to D&D by the fans. It wasn't really...
I mean, this may be at fault. This may be at fault with my definition of role playing because I almost see it as sort of acting in a way.
Right. Mm. If you imagine it in that way, it definitely is something that's separate from D&D design.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, a lot of the early D&D and a lot of D&D that still takes place now is about laying down a grid or a map. This is your dungeon.
Yeah.
And it's about navigate around the dungeon in the most strategically advantageous way.
Right.
Have encounters with monsters.
Yeah.
Bring up their stat blocks. Roll the dice. Did you hit? Didn't you hit?
Yeah.
And you could do that 100% without engaging in any kind of role playing. I would argue that there is, in fact, more of a place for role playing in D&D, though, because narrative decisions dictate the roles that come after them.
That's true.
And storyline decisions and acting can serve to give you advantages in play, too, because the DM can say, oh, you know, you played that pretty well. Let me give you a bonus to this role. It's kind of cobbled on. The role-playing's kind of taped on to D&D with duct tape, you know, and jerry-rigged. Yeah. But it's easier to jerry-rig the original role-playing game into a role-playing game.
Yeah.
And perhaps it is with, say, Demi Lich or some other games that have...
And one other thing real quick. It also depends on viewpoint, because if you're going to try and sort of metagame it, it's a completely different experience than trying to think, what would my character do in this battle situation? And act differently because you're thinking that.
That's true.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think there's also a real tendency to look at games that are more character-centric as having more role-playing in them, even like D&D.
Right.
More character-centric game than, say, Demi Lich.
You think it is?
Character. Oh, character is in, you're inside the dude's body. You're not controlling a bunch of resources. You're not, you're not acting, you know, for influence in a court around you. You're just your guy.
Right.
And so I think there's a kind of a more tendency to see those as role-playing games, even when they, you know, don't necessarily have a lot of elements of role-playing.
That's interesting, So the closer the...
The more character autonomy you really... Maybe not autonomy is not the right word. The more
the game is centered on, the tighter the relationship between you and a single character that you have agency over, the more it seems like a role-playing game.
Yeah. And it's what I would call sphere of vision.
Yeah.
Great, yeah.
Yeah.
Although, arguably, though, some very narrative-heavy games, some story games, are very far from that.
Yeah.
Something like Microscope. I haven't played Microscope, but from reviewing it, you know, you're not controlling a single character. You're controlling the timeline of history of a universe.
Right.
And would we say, or would someone step... Excuse me, I'm sorry. Would someone step back from that and say, well, this isn't a role-playing game at all. This is simply a storytelling game? Because
somebody might, yeah.
Yeah, people might.
Yeah.
It depends on your views and whatnot on that, too, like before, but I haven't read anything about that. I'd have to read further.
You can take on characters in Microscope, but the way I understand it is it's a kind of zoom-in, zoom-out mechanic, where you zoom in and you narrate history, and then you'll zoom in on individual sections in history, individual moments in history, and act those out in character. But I don't think that a character in one scene that you control in one scene necessarily is the character you'll be controlling throughout the game. In fact, it can't possibly be.
No.
Right.
So, very interesting. Yeah. The scope of what we consider to be role-playing games.
Yeah. And there's going to be some muddy stuff in there that we might say is role-playing, but it doesn't really fit our strict definition of what we said here, too, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes, though, designs are actually... Whoa, Obi, hello. He really wants to participate. I think that sometimes a design may simply be more fun without it trying to shoehorn role-playing in.
Yeah.
And I don't think being a role-playing game is some badge of honor or something that you need to strive to. I think it's a design decision whether you want to emphasize that fact. Yeah. And if you don't want to emphasize it, it may be best to, you know, extricate it from the design totally.
Maybe, yeah.
And Rudy, you actually, we had an experience with a game that you designed that kind of falls into this discussion. You want to talk about it?
Yeah, well, I designed Blood Libel.
Which was mentioned on a previous podcast.
Yeah, it basically wound up play with the drawing tool, which was kind of fun.
It had a Pictionary mechanic that involved an applet that you programmed or designed in Game Maker. And that applet let you draw in blood, basically, Pictionary.
Yeah, well, what I found is that mechanic really can't work for Evolution because it sucks too much out of the game.
It took over the game.
Yeah.
The game became a kind of storytelling game where you drew pictures and other people interpreted them.
Yeah.
And then you draw pictures in response and interpreted them. And everyone had a fucking blast, an absolute blast playing it.
Yeah. But not necessarily the game I wanted to design.
Right. So, Demulich.
Yep.
Just building off the discussion we had, I would say right away, personally, I almost think it might be better to not make this a role-playing game. I felt like, in the beginning, I was role-playing my character, and, you know, I was enjoying it, you know, but as the game developed, it felt like, oh, I don't even want to bother to roleplay my character. I want to move forward with the strategy elements of the game. And as Gnome is listening to our playtest, he'll probably be able to notice the roleplaying draining out of the game as it progresses. But it just seemed like the strategy elements were fun. Maybe a little bit of narrative there to string things together, but maybe not too much emphasis on roleplaying, or maybe it doesn't need any emphasis on roleplaying.
Yeah. Well, there's a big key here. I think we asked once or twice to each other, do you want to roleplay this?
Yeah.
Exactly.
And sometimes the answer was, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah.
And other times it was just, nah, I think we understand what happened.
Yeah, we shouldn't have to ask that question, I think is my point.
Right. And if people are asking that question a lot, maybe it's time to water down or remove the roleplaying elements in your game.
Yeah.
The current strategy part of the game was lots of fun.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
I'm a sucker for games that have elements of other types of design.
Yes.
So, like, I don't think he should totally remove the role-playing elements from it. I think he should just emphasize it, like, how they can be used in examples, and emphasize that really they're kind of secondary to the action parts, if that's what he wants to do. But I think it's a good way to get people into role-playing, these types of collective storytelling games. It's like, well, what will we do now? It's like, well, you talk as your guy or whatever.
Right.
And people are like, well, what's, you know, and then you do it, and then people gradually learn to do that, and then they move on to other games, maybe.
Maybe. That's true. I mean, maybe if there was more of a mechanical reward for role-playing or more of a mechanical connection.
Yeah, I think you can easily put that into the mechanics. The card mechanics where, say, like, if you role-play a scene, you can better justify using this, this, and this, you know.
Yeah.
I think there's right chance for that in the shit-talking.
Yeah, there is.
Shit-talking mechanic, definitely.
In fact, I would like to see the shit talk fleshed out a bit.
Yeah. Me too.
For our listeners who maybe haven't read Gnome's document, first of all, go read it. It's 9 pages. You have no excuse.
Seriously.
Second of all, the game contains a mechanic that he describes as Demulich Facebook.
Yes.
Basically, the Demuliches have some kind of
psychic link.
Yeah, social psychic network connecting them. And they can go to other Demuliches and basically talk shit at them and, like, making a derogatory post on someone's Facebook wall.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see that fleshed out more in it.
Yeah, no, that should definitely be.
I mean, we didn't even use it that much. I think Hank was the only one to really use it in the game.
I've used it a couple of times.
Yeah.
But it just seems like something that should be rewarded because these liches hate each other.
That's why
they're liches.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it also creates more of a connection between what's going on in the isolated worlds of each Demulet.
Right.
Yeah.
Because since they're such powerful figures, usually they have a group of followers,
yeah.
and they're a skull, so they're not walking around, you know?
Yeah.
They're not coming in direct physical contact with each other.
Yeah.
Some mechanical points. One thing, I feel like there isn't much reason to have lots of small units, or small assets is the term
it
of the
not,
game.
Yeah.
Because one big asset, can, so, since all combat is asset on asset combat, one
yeah.
asset on another, excuse me, there's one big asset can just go turn to turn, steamrolling all the smaller, smaller assets.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if there were mechanics that let you... use smaller assets to reinforce each other, build on each other, or if later in the game you could cannibalize your smaller assets and put them into your bigger one.
Well, and one thing that I think I would like to see is reward players for keeping all three of their three types of their assets.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Because there's no reward for that right now. But.
Right. And in fact, I won the game at the end without any of my original three assets left.
Right.
Right.
I still had a type of asset, since all assets have a type. I had, Clout. I still have some Clout left. But it wasn't my original Clout.
Right.
It was some Clout I had developed later in the game.
Right.
So that's definitely
one thing I think there also should be is something that lets two liches work together against a bigger one.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's
a smaller one or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we reached an end point where it became almost inevitable because I was the only one with a big resource left.
Right.
Yeah.
Or a big asset, excuse me.
This is Parliament. All three parties are fighting each other and nothing's really going on. One's going to take over, but nobody's going to get a confidence vote.
Right.
That's true.
And you get... And once you get whittled down to a certain point, you kind of get sidelined in the game. So if you could then go in and support someone else, it might give you more of a role.
That's true. Because I'm sure each of the liches doesn't want to see anyone else win, except themselves.
Right, exactly, exactly. And I think...
One thing I noticed also is that there's no real reason to put resources back once you win them.
Yes.
Because, I mean, it's the next person's turn, so they're just going to take them from you, and you can't really do anything with them.
Right, and this is in a situation where you're attacking another player.
Yeah.
And after you attack another player, if you succeed in beating the asset that you're attacking, you have a choice. You can take that asset and put it in the discard pile, or you can put it back into the... common area in the center of the table. But if it gets put in the common area, you don't get a chance to make a play for it until your next turn,
so
it will have gone all the way around the table.
Or in a two-player game, the person you just took it from has a chance to get it back
first. Get it back, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And since it's 2 to 3 players maximum, odds are good that you're either going to give it back to who you took it from, or some other guy is going to ninja loot it.
Yeah. Well, like I said in a previous podcast, I feel this could go higher than 3 people, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
But maybe no more than 4 or 5.
Yeah, I don't see any reason why the mechanics of this game need to be limited to 3 players.
No.
Maybe role-playing reasons in that it gets kind of complex narrating with that many players. But really, I don't see that we had plenty of cards left over.
Yeah.
We could have easily dealt another person into the game.
Oh, yeah, easily.
I mean, you might have a long game under those circumstances, but we didn't have a particularly long game with 3 players, so...
No.
And the rules actually support going between sessions.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
So, I see no reason to make it maximum, like you said, Mike, 5 players.
Yeah.
A few editorial points. I understand that this was a very rough draft, written in 24 hours for the Ronnie contest. So, obviously, it is not going to be the best possible work from a editorial perspective, from a language perspective. But he did neglect to say that you needed dice to play the game. And
he
neglect in the things you need to play section. You only discover that when you're reading through the game. And he never specifies exactly what kind of die you're rolling. We assumed it was a D6 because context clues made us think that. Mm. But it could have been a D4.
It could have been a D10.
Could have been a D8. I mean, there's no way to tell. So that's something that really, in order to, for people to be able to play the game, that information has to be in there.
Mm. Yeah.
There were places where it could have been structured in a clearer way, especially when you get into the actual mechanics of play, into the dice and card mechanics and how they interact. That could have been fleshed out and clarified a bit and organized in a way so that terms are clearly defined before they're mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And,
Yeah.
Any other thoughts?
Maybe ambitions. I wasn't sure what ambitions really were.
Yes, they never really came into play. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess my character achieved his ambition.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, I guess maybe win condition or something. Or win reward, you know what
mine
I mean?
Mine, I wound up kind of setting out of the bounds of the game by accident. So didn't really.
Well, it wasn't outside of the bounds of the game because you had set your goal as killing someone who wasn't one of the other players. But you could have made him... You could have added him to the common pool as an NPC and then attacked him. Mm. And in fact, no mentions that possibility in manual.
Yeah, okay.
So you could have constructed him out of the common resources that existed.
That makes sense.
But yeah, having better instruction for setting ambitions.
Yeah. And maybe making them do something more than what they do.
Simply being, because they're not really a win condition.
No,
because there's
no.
An entirely different win condition, which is actually beating the other players.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, it's not clear what the ambitions do except provide motivation for your character during some of the role playing sessions.
Yeah.
Also, how they became a lich doesn't really come into play.
No, I think that's just for flavor.
Just for flavor. But I would have liked to have seen more ways to integrate that into play so that flavor comes up more.
That's true.
Trying to think if there's anything else.
Maybe the stats. Ancient, I wasn't really sure about. I mean, I guess it just lets you roll more dice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gives you a bonus die to implement, or as many as you have points in there to use later. And that did get used, especially during the end game, which was kind of cool.
Yeah. Although something that came up very common is whatever we put 3 points in at the beginning, that was sort of our crutch.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point, Mike.
Yeah.
And you were always trying to figure out, how am I going to use the stat I put 3 points in to accomplish this? And usually the situations were so flexible and your powers were so flexible that you could say, I can use my influence for this. In fact, we put, all of us had our 3 in influence, and influence kind of feels like the most flexible stat, too.
Yeah.
Because since most of what you're doing is going to be involving your henchmen, your mooks, to use the terminology of the game, or your influence in society or whatever.
Yeah.
Influence always seems somehow applicable unless the guy is, standing in front of you in your tower poking you in the eye.
Yeah.
Well, the eye socket.
Yeah. Exactly. There was... And with 3 people as creative as we are, we really had no trouble working in everything we needed into
that.
We bowed over a couple times just because we didn't want to really bother, but...
Yeah. And sometimes it was fun to handicap yourself by saying, how can I use my worst stat in this one?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, we are only at a half an hour mark. We are only halfway through
the
podcast.
Yeah, we have a short podcast.
Well, any so final fun. Thoughts on Demi-Lich?
I'd like to see maybe rules for multiple sessions, maybe.
Mm.
Because that's mentioned once in here, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, and just in passing.
Yeah.
And otherwise, it seems like a very self-contained game.
Yeah, it seemed like you just pick it up and play. Kind of.
Do you draw a new? Do you create a new common pool for the beginning of a second session?
Yeah.
That would be worthwhile, I think.
Yeah, that'd be kind of
cool. Yeah, that would be actually kind of good.
Because I could let a player that's behind get ahead.
Right. In fact, I'd like to see some kind of mechanic for refilling the common pool, period.
Right.
Yes. Because it seemed like pretty much people raided those resources right away at the beginning. And then after that, you got whittled down, and there wasn't much you could do but wait to die.
That's true.
Yep. It's like scheme, so everybody's behind the black curtain, right. And then all the nukes come out, just wait to see who has more. Yeah.
And I mean, in some ways, that kind of makes thematic sense with the game, because you have the idea of the demi-liches callously using all of the world's resources, you know, and then, oh well, you know, the resources are gone, you've consumed everything, and now you're just fighting with each other.
Right. Yeah.
And you've left a wasteland behind you, you know.
Very typical war there, but
yeah.
There's no surprise elements, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Especially with the three demi-liches that we had.
Yeah.
Yeah, where you had the capitalist demi-lich, and the sociopathic demi-lich, and the popular culture demi-lich.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, there were some pretty awesome moments. Mike, final thoughts.
Final thoughts. Very good game, not crippled by its flaws, but but it just needs minor tweaks, I think.
Right.
So, I mean, there's details that need worked out.
Right. And that's exactly what they are. They are details.
Yeah.
This isn't a case where the fundamental design is flawed at all. And for a game, once again, made in 24 hours, you expect there to be things that need polish. But the fundamental design of this game, I think, is very strong. Hmm. And as far as my final thoughts are concerned, initially, when we did our first Ronnie Awards podcast, and we ranked all the games, Rudy, you put this at number 2. Mike, you put this at number 2. I left this off my list. Well, I can safely say I should not have left it off my list. It's a very good design. And I think I kind of neglected it, first of all, because I knew it was on your list, Rudy, and I was trying to create a list that was mostly unique. Yeah. But I think I also neglected it because I was like, this is too much of a game. And having played it, maybe it is a game, but it's a very fun game.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything derogatory or wrong about it being a game. And it definitely stands up with the best games from that round of the Ronnie Awards.
Yeah. Yes, very much so.
I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
I like liches because they're cool.
Yeah, you have a real love affair with liches and the undead in general.
Yes.
definitely. Maybe could use some polish in the rules text, but it was written in 24 hours.
So yeah.
Yeah.
It was pretty easy to understand.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
Nope.
I don't think the rules text needs much to work on other than what's missing.
Yeah.
What was
the omissions are.
Yeah, because even for me, it's very easy to read.
Mm.
And having read it once, you can just go back over it in about 10, 15 minutes and understand everything again, which is very good for a game, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
As far as whether or not it's a role-playing game, I don't really care.
It was fun, so
I played Monopoly as a role-playing game, so.
Really?
Yeah.
You have?
Yeah, when I was here, remember we were role-playing the gentrification and shit.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And James was like, what the fuck are you guys doing?
That was pretty awesome, yeah. Yeah, we will turn anything into a role-playing game. Yeah. You especially, that's your thing, is taking any game and making it a role-playing game.
I've tried doing Battleship as a role-playing game.
Yeah.
And Battleship would make an awesome role-playing game. Like, especially with the weepy sob stories taking place, like on the aircraft carrier as it slowly bombed to death.
We were doing it Pacific War. That was good.
Well, I could just see that moment, though, when, you know, there's the four pillars of smoke on the aircraft carrier. Yeah. And you know you're done. You're cradling, like, your comrade who just got his arm or leg blown off, and you're crying, and you know that last bomb's about to come down.
Yeah.
There's something awesome about the fatalism of Battleship as a role-playing game.
Right.
Because you know once they hit your ship once, it's like, oh shit, they found me. Once they hit it twice, it's like,
I'm done. I'm sunk. But you still have to wait for it to be hit maybe two more times, three more times if it's an aircraft carrier.
Yeah, sure.
Imagine playing the people on board one of those ships when they know they're dead. They know they're going down.
Yeah.
All men, all hands on board, motherfuckers!
Yeah.
It sounds like a session of Fiasco, maybe.
Yes! Yeah.
Battleship Fiasco. Get on that, Jason Morningstar.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Man. You have... Rudy, is there any type of game that you have not turned into a role-playing game?
I don't know.
Because you've made chess into a role-playing game. You've used chess in several designs. You've used board game-centric designs. You've used a craps-centric design.
Craps.
You've used Pictionary now.
Poker? No. I don't play poker.
Because you don't know the poker rules?
Or
you just don't like poker as a game? Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
Of course, poker has already been used in some ways by other story games.
Yeah.
That's true.
And dice systems that mimic poker have been used.
Yeah, I tried making one involving backgammon.
Backgammon, yes, that's right. Yeah. You need to dust off that design and bring it back now that Gary's not here to ruin the game.
I know, right? I need to be less flexible.
Harkin.
And if there's anyone who's listening to Mom's Basement Podcast who actually listened to our atrocious old episodes, first of all, we're sorry. But second of all, you can also, you know then that we've discussed Mike's game Harkin in the past.
Yep. And stuff.
Harkin.
I gotta dust that off and maybe open it back up to the public.
I need to sit down and actually get some of my games done here. I have a bunch that are playable and have been played that are mechanically finished, but I am really apathetic when it comes to putting down things in text form. And I need to go and get some finished drafts. I need to do a finished draft of Six Page Manual. I need to do a finished draft of Dance Macabre. And I really need to right away do a draft of my new game, Passing, for the Taste of Blood anthology.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe we will talk about our Taste of Blood games on a future podcast. Yeah. There's a possibility that we might be talking about other people's Taste of Blood games, because we might be playtesting them if they take me up on my offer to playtest them in the basement. So there could be some fun to be had there.
Yes, very much so.
You know, I noticed that someone on our What Do You Want in Season 2 poll actually posted for, voted for more random bullshit.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, I know you voted for it once, Rudy, but
someone else did.
So maybe we should give them some more random bullshit. We have like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what sort of random bullshit?
I don't know.
I mean, this is not the Craig Ferguson Late Show, so our random bullshit is very limited by what we can think of, which isn't very much, admittedly.
That's true.
I'm drawing pictures of peckers on my fucking...
You are drawing pictures of penises, and it looks like there are people riding the penises.
There are.
It looks like the penis version of the cover of the Neverending Story.
Yeah, it does.
Yes. Yes, I mean, this thing is like a big example of... This is like the perfect sheet of anyone that's on like the Hijinks and Sue podcast. If anybody listen to this, because there's so much penis. There's even a random God is Great, which seems like something random one of those guys would actually put on a sheet.
Right.
There's the word AIDS just randomly on this thing.
Suck it.
She's walking.
Mine is somehow clean and free of peckers.
Yeah, mine has numbers on it, because I was doing my math on the sheet.
Yeah.
That's, these are demi-lit sheets we're talking about that are still in progress. The fact that mine hasn't really been vandalized is really amazing.
Yeah.
I tend not to vandalize mine, but I don't really know what to put on. Actually, my drawing is shit.
I actually lit my Harkin sheet on fire. Remember that?
Yes, you did.
I burned half of it up so I could just see the stats that I had.
Wow. Why did you do that?
No. Because there was fire there. Because we were in the headquarters.
Because we were in the headquarters, and that was the night the bat took over.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yes. That's one of the hidden podcasts, I think,
that
right?
That is one of the hidden podcasts. Where we actually flee the podcast because the bat is flying like gone. 6 inches from our head and we're talking. And then like half an hour of dead air on that podcast because we all went into hiding.
Yeah, we went into hiding because this bat was going in between the attic and where we were playing. And it was just the most random thing ever.
Right.
You never see this. And it was awesome, but I don't want to get fucked up by a bat.
It was performing aerial maneuvers and shit, and it was dive bombing us.
Yeah, it was.
It would come down from the rafters and it didn't actually make a noise, but I imagined it was. I was screaming and running outside.
Well, it was making a noise because it's a fucking bat and it has echolocation.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was making a noise we couldn't hear.
Yeah, making noise.
But we wouldn't leave the place. We left the door open. Damn thing wouldn't leave.
I don't know what happened to that.
Eventually, it retreated back up to the upper floor and wherever it was hiding originally.
Yeah, probably taking care of its babies or whatever. Fucking bats, man.
Yeah. But I mean, you don't know with rabies and shit. I mean, it was night. It was the middle of the night.
Yeah, it's probably just out.
Right. It was middle of the night in October.
Yeah, that's true. So why wouldn't there be a bat?
Really. Why wouldn't there be a bat? We're fucked anyway.
Here's a topic of conversation that has been coming up a lot on the from the Story Games Twitter crowd. Sucker Punch. There's been a lot of people who are like, oh, Sucker Punch. Why did the critics shit on Sucker Punch?
Have they seen it?
Yes, some of them have.
And they liked it? Just to make sure.
At least one or two of them liked it. I think it was probably a split opinion. But yeah, I don't know.
That movie looks like a good game.
That's how I feel about whenever I see a Zack Snyder movie, I'm like reaching for the controller. I'm like, how is this a quick time event? Why isn't the X flashing on the screen? You know?
Hey.
The 300 would have been an awesome beat 'em up role playing, not role playing, a beat 'em up game.
Yeah.
Or this video game.
Sucker Punch doesn't actually look like that good of a game. It looks like some shithouse single player bullshit.
I haven't seen it, but I do want to see it, to be honest. But I've been hearing split opinion myself on it.
Yeah.
Just recently, within the last 2 days, within the last like 24 hours, is when I've been hearing any good news whatsoever about it. Huh. But then again, same thing was said of Battle LA. But weird part about that, people I know liked it. Critics hated it.
See, I don't want to see Battle LA.
I don't.
See that shit.
I really don't.
I really don't.
Aliens, that was part of Dick Taylor.
I don't know why. There really have not been that many good aliens.
You've been fairly good.
District 9 was a masterpiece.
Yeah.
But that was the last good one, in my opinion.
As far as I can think of it, in recent memory, that's...
Yeah.
Well, it's the first one that comes to mind, anyway, and that says a lot.
But as far as Sucker Punch is concerned, I'm not a big Zack Snyder fan.
Yeah.
Haven't been at all. Zack Snyder is highly literal in his interpretations.
Yeah.
So... He does a pretty good job of doing a very direct, presentation of whatever he's adapting.
Yeah.
So, Watchmen, for example, did a very good job of frame by frame recreating the graphic novel.
Yeah.
Right up till the end.
Yeah.
We were diverting where it got all the shit.
Right. but it did not do a very good job of understanding the time period that the graphic novel was released in and taking those thoughts and ideas that Alan Moore had at that time and presenting them in a way that takes into account all the shit that's happened since then. And the fact that What Watchmen did was revolutionary when it was first released, because it was the first time it's like, holy shit, neurotic superheroes, you know, dealing with the kind of emotional problems that real people deal with. It was the first time that you really had a graphic novel. Well, it probably wasn't the first time, honestly, but it was one of the first examples of a graphic novel that really dissected and analyzed what other superhero comics were doing. But today, a lot of those observations seem trite.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, it's partly because so many of those observations are actually put into comics these days.
Right, exactly.
They aim for some realism.
Right, and not only comics, but comic book movies now.
Yeah.
If a scene-by-scene recreation of Watchmen, Zack Snyder style, had been released in 1996, it would have been a big deal. But when it was released a year after The Dark Knight, nothing in it seemed revolutionary.
That's true.
Right.
In fact, the psychology on display there actually seemed shallow and, like I said, trite or superficial compared to what was going on in The Dark Knight. So...
Yeah, I think that's kind of...
Yeah. Got hit up by that.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't help also that I guess Alan Moore wasn't very cooperative with anyone.
No, he never is.
That's also part of the problem.
Yeah, that's always part of the problem with his adaptations.
And somehow he lost some respect over this. I don't know how. I don't follow it that closely.
But, okay. I think the 300, Zack Snyder did, once again, he did a very literal remake of that. And I think that succeeded because there wasn't much to it besides style. That book was very much about a stylistic recreation of this historical moment with a lot of flair and over-the-top bullshit. And Zack Snyder really nailed that. Once again, it was basically a video game, but it was stylish.
Well, the key there also was that it was based in an actual event. Whereas you take that versus Watchmen or anything and any of these other things.
Right.
There's no actual events in this shit. Okay, so Sucker Punch is based in Brattleboro, Vermont, and in a place that used to exist.
Right.
Besides that, none of it's fucking real.
Right. There really is no real world
That's the thing.
Connection there. And but I think that kind of gets at what might have gone wrong with Sucker Punch, which is that Zack Snyder, as I said, has been doing one highly literal, stylistic remake. Or stylized remake of an existing property after another. He did Dawn of the Dead. He did 300. He did Watchmen. And now he's trying to do an original work. And it's clear that he is not a man who has a great capacity for original ideas.
Yeah.
Because, well, wasn't Sucker Punch a graphic
novel? No. Sucker Punch
I thought it was.
No, it's based on an original script that he came up with somebody. Let me see.
Thank you,
Wikipedia.
Yeah, for ease of information.
Film. Sucker Punch, the film is an action fantasy film written by Steve Shibuya and Zack Snyder. The script, which was penned by Snyder in Shibuya, was finalized in five months and was actually planned to be made before Watchmen.
Oh, I could have sworn that was a graphic novel.
Me too. Because there was a lot of people that was pumped because of that reason, but I don't know.
I mean, it looks like a...
It does have that feel too.
Right. I'm trying to see if... Yeah, I had written a script for myself. How can I make a film that can have action sequence in it that aren't limited by the physical realities that normal people are limited by, but still have the story to make sense so it's not bullshit? Well,
is it R-rated?
No, it's PG-13.
Oh, that's
but that's because, you know, PG-13 because you're trying to get, like, 16-year-olds there.
Right.
Because it's an all-female.
Watchmen bombed in a theater.
Yes.
And so now Zack Snyder is expected to write films for the broadest audience possible.
Yes.
So it had to get a PG-13 rating.
Yeah, I thought that was supposed to be a hard R.
So. No. His first three movies were R-rated. But... No, I don't think... I mean, I could be wrong here. I haven't seen the film. I'm going entirely by what critics have said about it. I don't expect it to be a film that I want to see.
I doubt that, too, because it looks like a heavy action film.
Yeah.
But the review that I've seen says There's not much action here besides what you've seen in the previews, which makes me question what.
Yeah, that's kind of...
So that's another reason why I kind of want to see it.
Mm. Yeah.
That review may be completely misplaced.
Maybe. I mean, it's hard to say. Yeah. But I don't know. Basically, I'm holding out for a Neil Blomkamp's next film. Whatever it turns out to be, he's working on one. That is almost certainly going to be awesome, because District 9, as I said, a masterpiece.
Yes. Yeah, hopefully it will be awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen people take shits before.
Yeah, shit. I mean, you never know.
But hopefully.
I mean, I honestly wasn't expecting much out of District 9 originally, because I was like, oh, executive producer Peter Jackson. Peter Jackson. Yeah. And I have a long history of hatred towards Peter Jackson and everything he does. I've never seen a movie so effectively combine social commentary and comedy and the sci-fi action summer blockbuster movie and have it come together and have a stylish original design with the documentary handheld camera style.
Yeah.
I've never seen all of those elements go together in a way that was successful without ever being superficial, which was really could equally be enjoyed as a summer popcorn blockbuster and as a really smart satire.
Yes.
I mean, having all those elements come together in a movie as effectively as happened in District 9, I thought it was just an amazing accomplishment.
Yeah, all I know is there's going to be a lot of shit movies coming out in the next world.
Yeah.
Cowboys versus Aliens? Did that come out yet?
Oh, yeah.
Once again, video games Video games and internet memes influencing movie design.
Although that one is a video game within a video game, because the main character has a fucking power glove on his arm that controls alien shit.
Oh, wow.
I just don't know what to think of that. When I first saw the trailer for that, I thought, this is going to be shit. And everybody loved it.
Wow.
But that's the weird thing. Movies I typically see in the trailers that I think are going to be shit typically turn out to be way better than I thought they were going to be.
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah. It's
so very hard. I mean, trailers are by their nature deceptive.
Yes. And I also end up being very terrible as a judge of how good a movie is from its trailer.
Anyway. Yeah, I can't even begin to guess. The only way I can draw any inferences is not by the content of the trailer, but by the movie it's coming before. Often, if the trailer is coming before a good movie, it's probably a trailer for a good movie. Not always. Sometimes it's some bullshit. Right.
Some, yes.
But often it's a trailer for a good movie.
That's true.
And we have burned up most of our time. Hope that people enjoyed our random bullshit. Yeah. Any final random bullshit thoughts, Rudy?
Girls are nice.
Really? Do you know this from personal experience?
No, I've never spoken to a girl.
Oh, come on.
Oh, come on, man.
You have a mother.
Yeah, I've talked to my mom.
You've spoken to girls that weren't your mother.
No, I haven't.
Fucking liar.
I'm
bullshit.
I have a cousin.
That doesn't count. But you know.
Played D&D with my sister for 3 years.
That's true.
But she's not a girl?
No, she's a girl.
Okay.
Talk to other girls that weren't fucking...
Somebody get a fire going.
Fucking tear down this fucking roof.
What you might be saying is you haven't flirted with any girls.
Nope.
That's probably true.
Relevant.
That's probably true.
I don't know. Really.
My sheet is now so full that I can't draw anything else on it.
There's a little bit on the side here.
Yes, your character sheet is covered in penises. Yeah. Maybe one of these things is directly connected to the other.
Maybe.
It's like avant-garde art.
Yeah, it's like fucking...
Well, I was talking about the, I've never had a conversation with a woman.
Oh.
Or a girl, rather. You didn't say woman.
Yes.
That's true.
And drawing hundreds of penises on your character sheet.
Maybe.
Maybe?
Girls like to do that stuff, too, though.
That's true. Well, I mean, in that people like to do it. I'm not sure if there's, you can really make much of that girl versus boy dichotomy.
Nah,
I don't think it's a particularly valuable dichotomy when you're talking about behavior. Yeah. It's like, oh, only dudes play role-playing games. It's like, nah.
Nah, I fucking hope not. God. If that was the case, I'd be so screwed. Then I would definitely have to go to anime conventions.
Oh, dude, you should go to fucking cosplay type shit.
Oh, there's one up in Montreal that comes around, I think, every summer. I don't remember what it's called off the top of my head.
An anime convention?
Yeah. They always hold one up in... I want to say it's a Hayukan.
Oh, Hayukan.
That's what I want to say it is. And, of course, there's one in Ottawa, too, but that's a little further away.
I know almost nothing about anime.
Anime is awesome.
I don't think I've ever seen an anime film all the way through.
Really?
I've seen some episodes.
Not even Spirited Away or any of it?
No.
Really? Yeah, it may be easier to start with the Spirited Away clan.
We sat down and we watched Pom Poyo.
Oh, Pom Poko. Yeah.
Pom Poko.
Man, that movie. Were you there when we watched that?
No.
The raccoon dogs with the giant testicles.
Yep.
I know what you're talking about.
That was a classic.
I have not seen that one yet, but that's not... I'm always lazy in watching anime, and I'm not, like, all into it and shit. But there's some select series I'll watch.
Mm.
Oh, Jesus.
Any final bullshit thoughts, Mike?
Nothing else from me.
Nothing else? I got nothing.
I think this is conclusion.
Yeah, I say that concludes episode 27 of Mom's Basement Podcast.
Yep.
Next week, we will be talking about the game Keystone, which is a game of messianic fantasy.
Yep.
Yes.
We'll talk about what exactly that means next time, and we'll talk about Keystone, and we'll probably have some more random bullshit or some other topic. Okay.
Okay.
So that's Mom's Basement Podcast signing off.
Ah.
Ah!